Well, good evening to you all, and welcome to the final lecture in the Miliband series on inequality, which has been running more or less the whole of the academic year. While my last but not least speaker needs no introduction, that has never been a reason for me not to introduce someone, and I would like to say something briefly about Richard's career, because it's a remarkable and unusual one in many respects. Richard grew up in the Cabrini Green Housing Project in Chicago, coming from a family of Russian emigres. As a child, his passion was music, and in adolescence already, by early adolescence, he worked as a musician, studying the cello and conducting, playing in chamber music ensembles throughout the American Midwest. He was a prodigy. And his meteoric rise in the musical world, however, was brought to a dramatic end by a hand injury. At what age, Richard? Hand injury?
23.
And after that, he changed tack and entered academic life. He trained at Harvard with David Riesman, Eric Erickson, and Oscar Handlin. And his intellectual life as an urbanist took shape at the Joint Center for Urban Studies, a joint center with Harvard and MIT. In the course of his scholarly writings and career, he's explored urban family patterns, the work careers of city dwellers, class relations in the city, the urban welfare system, and the relation of these social structures to architecture, urban design, and planning. And he's also analyzed the history of public culture and traced the intertwined history of medical knowledge about the body and the design of buildings. It's an extraordinary, interesting set of engagements. And his list of distinguished publications, and I say distinguished, but it's not just a list of publications, his list of distinguished publications is extraordinary. And many of these books are already classics. And you may or may not know that they are in sociology as well as in fiction. In sociology, among his best-known books, most recently is Respect in an Age of Inequality. Before that, The Corrosion of Character, The Personal Consequences of Work in the New Capitalism. Flesh and Stone, The Body and the City in Western Civilization, no less. The Conscience of the Eye, going back a little bit more in time, and that Authority, The Fall of Public Man, and an absolute pivotal book when I was a graduate student, The Hidden Injuries of Class. And that's just a selection. And then in fiction, he's published Palais Royal, The Frog Who Dared to Croak, I was, you know, don't they all? and An Evening of Brahms. And so we have to welcome a sociologist extraordinaire, and I welcome you all this evening, to borrow a phrase, with an evening of Senate. Richard will speak this evening on the theme of culture inequality, a talk about talent. This is not mainly autobiographical, but talent he certainly has in abundance. So join with me to welcome him all.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me if I'm away from the microphone? Does this thing work? Very frightening. I'm really glad to give this Ralph Miliband lecture. Ralph Miliband was a great guide to me as a student, and his writing has been a constant source of inspiration to me as a researcher. So this is a really special occasion for me. I'm going to talk to you tonight about something that inaugurates a new phase of my work. And I'm going to be talking about the ways in which talent and ability are constructed in modern society and sometimes deconstructed. I guess if I had to just put in a sentence what I want to say to you tonight, it's that in the modern skills economy, the talents, people's abilities, are often being disempowered. And I want to explain to you the way in which, in a supposedly skills-oriented society, this disempowerment occurs. I'm going to talk to you at appalling length tonight about three subjects, and you'll have to use like a hook to stop me. You have to vote, and you all know the correct party to vote for. other than for the two members of the Miliband party who are in the Miliband family, who are in another party than the correct party. We won't pursue that. I'm going to talk about three issues about the way in which talent is socially constructed. The first has to do with the specter of uselessness. The second has to do with the relationship between craftsmanship and meritocracy in modern society. And the third has to do with the way in which potential ability is constructed in modern life. A defining image of the Great Depression in the 1930s was photographs of men clustered outside the gates of shuttered factories, waiting for work despite the evidence before their eyes. These photographs still disturb because the specter of uselessness has not ended. Its context has changed. Large numbers of people in the rich economies of North America, Europe, and Japan want work but can't find it. In the Great Depression, individuals believed in a personal remedy for uselessness, one which transcended any government nostrum. That is, that their children should get an education and a special skill which would make the young always needed, always employed. Today, too, that is the armor people seek. But again, the context has changed. In the skilled society, many of those who face unemployment are educated and skilled, but the work they want has migrated to places in the world where skills are cheaper. So skills of quite another kind are needed to deal with the economy in which we live. Now, I want to, in this lecture, explore how the specter of uselessness relates to the solution of education and skills formation. These would be a person's Bildung, as the Germans put it, formation. I guess this would be a good translation. The connection requires asking some basic questions. What does skill, and more comprehensively, talent, mean? How does being a talented person translate into economic value? In the skilled society, these are pressing problems because the economy may need only a relatively small number of the educated who possess talent, particularly in the cutting-edge realms of high finance, advanced technology, and sophisticated services, which are centered in cities like London and New York. That is to say that the economic urban machine may be able to run profitably and efficiently by drawing on an ever smaller elite. And that's the terrain that I want to look over with you tonight. Let me first talk about the specter of uselessness. In my view, three forces shape the specter of uselessness as a modern threat: the global labor supply, automation, and the management of aging. And each of these is not what it might at first glance seem. While the press writes scare stories about the global labor supply draining jobs from rich to poor places, the story is usually presented as a race to the bottom, simply in terms of wages. Capitalism supposedly looks for labor wherever labor is cheapest. And this story, it's important to understand, is half wrong. A kind of cultural selection is also at work. So the jobs leave high-wage countries, like the United States and Britain, but migrate to low-wage countries with skilled, sometimes overqualified workers. In other words, talent as well as wages plays a role in this. Indian call centers are a good example of this. The jobs in these centers are performed by people who are at least bilingual, and they refine their language skills so that the caller often doesn't know whether he or she has reached Hereford or Bombay. Many call center workers have had two or more years of university training, and on the job, they've been well trained. The wages for the work are abominable, paid to highly capable people. Something of the same phenomenon appears in some industrial jobs which have migrated to the global south. Here a telling instance is automobile sub-assembly plants on the northern border of Mexico. These are what are called maquiladoras. The people doing very routine forms of labor here are often highly skilled mechanics who have left auto body shops to work on the assembly line. Up north, line laborers in the Mexican maquiladoras might be subforemen or even foremen. We have in our minds the most fearful image of the economic race to the bottom, that of children leaving home and school to work in sweatshops in the global south. And as I say, the image is not false, but rather incomplete, because this is a labor market looking for talent on the cheap. The attractive factor to people with talent is that these temporarily low-skilled jobs have long-term positive effects. In call centers, and this is true of other forms of skills subcontracting to India, once people learn how they do it in the West, they begin forming subcontracted units of their own, small businesses that to which these larger businesses that have employed them then become subsequent contractors. So that it's the first way in to creating a company of one's own. In the Mexican case, the auto line workers have regular paid jobs by an American company, which means that they can get bank accounts. And once they can get bank accounts, they can get bank credit. And often they use bank credit to then start small auto shops of their own. So that from the receiving end, if we look at the outsourcing of talent in this way, it's not just a story of immiseration. It's this combination of the search for low wage labor with a kind of expropriating the opportunity for people to develop their talents. Now, the reason I stress this is the consequence at home. The people I've described so briefly are of higher status than their peers in the global north, if less well paid. The combination of motivation and training they're building constitutes a particular combination which draws employers. At home, the people who lose out would have had to increase their human capital to compete, but few can do so. Uncompetitive with these foreign peers, they face no longer being needed. The specter of uselessness here intersects with the fear of foreigners, which beneath its crust of simple ethnic or racial prejudice is inflected with the anxiety that the foreigners may be more talented, better armed for the tasks of survival in the global economy. And that anxiety has a certain basis in reality. So here's one thing that drives in today's economy, that drives the question of what talent is and how it's used. The second specter of uselessness lurks in automation. The fear of automation is very ancient. That is, that machines would take away the work of human beings, and particularly take away the work of skilled human beings. But for a long time, it remained that, a fear that really didn't have economic reality. And it was over-dramatized in the 19th century and early 20th century. Problem lay in the design and development of the machines themselves, and maybe I can interject here a personal example. My grandfather was an industrial designer who worked for 16 years, from 1925 to 1941, on the prototype of a robotic arm capable of 1 millimeter manipulation. The gears and pulleys required for this high-tech machine cost a fortune, and the robotic arm itself needed constant readjustment. After wasting a fortune on my grandfather, his employer decided that skilled human fingers were indeed cheaper. And that's been largely the story of automation up to the last 20 years, with the revolution in microelectronics and microprocessing. Thanks to this revolution, my grandfather's robotic arm today is a tool which can now be quickly and effectively designed on screen. Microprocessors take the place of the intricate, vulnerable gears and levers which he contrived. The same thing is true in service labor with the microprocessing revolution and things like voice recognition software, even the things the young people here would take for granted, like barcode readers. These have finally made automation real, and they've made it finally economic. Let me give you two examples of how economic it's become. From 1998 to 2002, the Sprint Corporation increased its productivity 15% by using advanced voice recognition software, and increased its revenues year on year 4.3%, while cutting its payroll over just this four-year period by 11,500 workers. In heavy industry, from 1982 to 2002, steel production in the United States rose from 75 million tons to 102 million tons, even as the number of steel workers dropped from 289,000 to 74,000. These are both automation gains, and the list is virtually infinite. These jobs were not exported. For the most part, sophisticated machines took over. The jobs simply disappeared, which is to say that modern workers are finally facing the specter of automated uselessness, where the claim of human skill is no longer as strong in any way as it used to be before. I want to mention just a third factor about this specter of uselessness, and it has to do with age. And it has to do in particular with the kinds of cutting-edge firms which I and my team, both here and in America, have been studying over the last decade. Finance services firms and high-tech firms, advanced services firms. Age has entered the picture of uselessness in two ways. The first is through sheer prejudice. When in the early 1990s I interviewed people in the advertising world, my subjects worried that they would be over the hill by the time they turned 30, out of it by the time they turned 40. The cutting-edge organizations in which they worked indeed tended to treat older employees as set in their ways, slow, losing energy. In advertising and media, the prejudice against age combines with views of gender. Middle-aged women, we found, were particularly stigmatized as lacking drive. And that was a stigma, a combination of age and gender, we also found in financial services firms. Age more directly touches on the question of talent, if we think about how long a skill lasts. If you are an engineer, how long will the skills you learned in university serve you? Well, the simple answer is less and less. Skills extinction, which is the phrase we came up with, has sped up not only in technical work, but in medicine, law, and various crafts. I'll give you just one statistic. One estimate for computer repairmen is that they have to relearn their skills three times in the course of their working lifetimes. And the same is true for doctors. That is, when you require a skill, you don't have a durable possession. The result of this, the human result of this kind of focus on age, which is particularly accentuated in high-skill labor, the consequence on young talent is that as experience increases, it has less value. And again, there's an economic reason for this. Firms find it cheaper to turn over the supply of young workers, particularly true in the engineering sector, than to retrain older ones. On-the-job training is a very expensive proposition. And the prejudice is that workers who need to be retrained aren't worth the candle, that it's more efficient to simply let them drift off, dismiss them, shorten their contracts, and start again with younger, more raw talent. Now, let me cut this. I am terribly long-winded. So this, in fine, are some of the things that drive the urgency of the question, what is talent today? What drives it are specters of uselessness, paradoxically, in a skilled society, so that large numbers of people, and old people as they age, face the threat that the experiential basis of their talents might count for less and less. In the second part of this talk, I want to say something about how this specter of uselessness relates to two ways of formulating what talent is, and they concern craftsmanship and meritocracy. And this is really the heart of what I want to talk to you about, and it's the new work that I've begun doing. Craftsmanship is a term most often applied to manual laborers and denotes the pursuit of quality in making a violin, watch, or pot. This is too narrow a view. Mental craftsmanship also exists as an effort to write clearly. Social craftsmanship might lie in forging a viable marriage. An embracing definition of craftsmanship would be doing something well for its own sake. Self-discipline and self-criticism adhere in all domains of craftsmanship. Standards matter, and the pursuit of quality becomes an end in itself. Craftsmanship emphasizes objectification. When Niccolo Amati made a violin, he did not express himself through the violin. He made a violin. Whatever his feelings, he invested himself in that object, judging himself by whether or not the thing was made right. Objectification means a thing made to matter in itself. This objectifying spirit can give even low-level, seemingly unskilled laborers pride in their work. For instance, my student Buddy Dill in the 1970s did a study of cleaning workers in Harlem, poorly paid black women, often abused by their white employers downtown. It is the most depressing piece of ethnography you could read. It's appalling. However, at the end of the day, these women salvaged some fragment of self-worth in having cleaned a house well, though they were seldom thanked for it. The house was clean. When I studied bakers in Boston in those same years, in a family-run bakery where the most junior members were treated roughly and pressed too hard by fathers and uncles, the results in the early morning similarly salved some of the upset. The bread was good. While it's important not to romanticize the balm of craftsmanship, as Ruskin did in the 19th century, it matters equally to understanding the consequence of doing something well for its own sake, because here ability counts for something by a measure which is both objective, concrete, and impersonal. Now, understood this way, craftsmanship sits very uneasily in the institutions of advanced capitalism. The problem lies in the last part of our definition, doing something well for its own sake. The more one understands how to do something well, the more one cares about it. But institutions based on short-term transactions, a constant turnover in the labor force, and shifting tasks do not breed that kind of depth. And indeed, the organization can fear it. The management code word here is ingrown, somebody who deeps dig into an activity just to get it right can seem to others ingrown in the sense of fixated on that one thing. And obsession is indeed necessary for the craftsman. he or she stands at the opposite pole from the consultant who swoops in and out but never rests. Moreover, deepening one's skills in any pursuit takes time. Usually, as most of you know, takes 3 or 4 years for a young professional fresh out of university to sort out what was really serviceable in the subject he or she studied. Deepening ability through practice sits at cross purposes with institutions that want people to do many different things in short order. While this kind of advanced capitalist organization, flexible in its operations, thrives on smart people, it has trouble if they become committed to craftsmanship. Now, a good example of this came to me in returning to a group of programmers I had once interviewed in a large but legally unmentionable software firm. If you can't guess who it is by the end of this paragraph, you have an apple. These programmers resented the firm's practice of shipping out incompletely formulated software in versions then corrected through consumer struggles and complaints. While deeply antipathetic to unions, the programmers were developing a loose professional movement called Craft in Code, demanding that the company desist from this highly profitable but poor quality practice. They wanted the time to get the programs right, their sense of meaningful work depending on doing this job well for its own sake. That's the kind of conflict between craftsmanship and the flexible frames of modern capitalism that I think is coming ever more to the fore, as I say, in the white-collar world, as among these engineers, as well as among manual laborers. Now, meritocracy stands, in a way, as the opposite of craftsmanship. And to understand why this is, and to understand, indeed, the resonances of the word, we have to go far back in time. When inheritance was the dominant fact of life for Europeans, there could be no concept of meritocracy in the sense we understand, that of giving to and rewarding a person for the job he or she does well. That is, that people deserve to be rewarded for their talent. In earlier times, people inherited offices in the church or the military, just as they inherited land, which is to say that positions were possessions, and which meant that it was a happy accident if a bishop happened to be religious, but not necessary as a qualification for the job. More gravely, in the world of armies and navies, in which the officers inherited their ranks, an incompetent commander, no matter how much suffering he caused, could not be dismissed from his post. He owned it. Inheritance did not smother the value placed on ability. Rather, one's station in life and one's competence were parallel social worlds. It was a Renaissance artist who first began to build a bridge across the two. Michelangelo, for instance, demanded his patrons submit to his genius, genius alone earning him rank. Benvenuto Cellini's autobiography shows how the demand began to challenge institutions, the demand for respect for talent alone. As a youth, Cellini entered the guild of guildsmiths, which was an elite craft in which many other Renaissance painters began their careers. Entry into this guild was largely, but not exclusively, by inheritance. Within a guild, people advanced only when someone higher up died or retired. Cellini, who I remind you lived from 1500 to 1571, jumped up, skipping the traditional progression, a man consumed by ambition for himself and his art. He accused guilds and other craftsmen institutions which did not reward talent alone and immediately of being corrupt. In that accusation sounds a new modern note, the equation of talent with merit. Ability entails a kind of moral prestige. This note is social as well as personal. Craftsmanship fits easily within the medieval guild frame, in that the apprentice, as much as the master, could seek to make something well for its own sake. Now, talent measured a new sort of social inequality. Creative or intelligent meant superior to others, a more worthy sort of person. In this enormous shift lay the passage from this, the equation of intelligent with superior, lay the passage from craftsmanship to meritocracy. Modern meritocracy took shape when institutions began to structure themselves on just this sort of inequality. One way to date this birth lies in the career of Samuel Pepys, as I've learned to pronounce him. It's odd British pronunciation. Pepys, a middle-class Briton who in the 1660s was one of the first officials able to make his way up in government by virtue of the fact that he was smart, particularly that he was good at adding and subtracting. In the Admiralty, he worked at provisioning the fleet. He had to reckon how many cannonballs and how much salt beef to put into ships. His claim was that he deserved this post because of his mathematical abilities, in preference to the Earl of Shrewsbury, whose second aunt was the niece of the then reigning monarch. In the person of Pepys, as it were, Cellini entered the portals of bureaucracy. Military organization was the domain in which notions of careers open to talent first made headway. Military academies like Saint-Cyr, founded in the late 17th century, forced young officers to learn the mathematics which enabled ballistic strategy. Military academies innovated in creating the first ability tests, a radical innovation in the 18th century. And you'll see in my book, I've reproduced one of these ability tests, quite amazing. In both Saint-Cyr and the Prussian military academies, these tests were incorruptible in the sense that the people tested appeared as numbers for the first time rather than as names. And in personal judgment, could be rendered, therefore, on the content of a person's brain. The tests provided a relatively objective measure of how capable an individual would be, certainly a more objective measure than family background or connections. The military institutions thus not only discovered talent, they objectified failure. This is perhaps even more important for our present concerns. Those who were stupid were eliminated no matter what their family background. This was important because a bureaucratic procedure now measured something deep inside the individual, punishing him and later her for lack of ability. That is to say, there isn't just a reward here. There's a necessary relationship between recognizing ability and quantifying failure. Absolute measures of incompetence only strengthened the merit of those succeeded, and in personal judgment, determining personal worth. Now, of course, class and cash still counted. Up to the early 18th century throughout Europe, a wealthy individual could buy an officer's commission. But now the professional soldier had come into being with a professional social prestige. The same structures came in time to govern the development of other professions in civil society, and with the same judgmental focus. Law, medicine, accounting, education, all eventually followed the military model. Business came last. The modern business school completes the transformation begun in Saint-Cyr. Today, businesses obsessively test and measure employees in the workplace in order that talent be rewarded and more consequently failure certified and so legitimated. I'm not going to talk about this, but I want to point out to you, this is a major point of the work I'm doing now, that this is one of the reasons that I make the argument for the essential militarization of civil society in the modern era. We make this distinction between military, domestic, military, and civilian, which is just bad sociology. And once you get into a phenomenon like what does it mean to test somebody for ability, this strong connection, the use of military models to understand civic rights and the like, and indeed ability, comes forward. Today, but I'm going to skip that tempting large byroad. Today, most arguments about preferential treatment in education and employment are for categories of people based on their race or class, and they turn on the way in which meritocracy took form two centuries ago as an impersonal judgment. On the one side, the argument is that the dominant society discriminates against subordinate groups. On the other, that society possesses the technical instruments to determine who, as a single individual, has ability. Suffusing the debate is a highly personal judgment. That is to say that the search for talent is no technical exercise. Merit is a far more personally intrusive category than competent. And I think I'm going to skip this as well. I now want to turn to some of the ways in which meritocracy favors a kind of definition of talent quite at odds with craftsmanship. In craftsmanship, we're able to judge how well somebody performs by looking at the concrete results of their labors. And to displaced or discarded workers, those results at least make legible why they have been cast aside. In the study I did of these Indian coal workers, and of reaction to these Indian coal workers, and it's also true for reaction to Chinese laborers, because the quality of Indian software programs, of coal work, and of Chinese manufactured goods are solid facts. People at least have a kind of standard to measure about something that has displaced them. There's an objective result. It might seem that the meritocratic machinery of testing and on-the-job evaluation would be equally solid. The measures are, after all, standardized, numbers often taking the place again of names on tests to assure objectivity. But in fact, this new kind of organization of work chases after something quite intangible. It chases after a set of practices in which little investment has been made, and indeed no investment. It chases after the development of potential ability rather than the rewards for owning and practicing a body of knowledge. And I want to turn now briefly to explaining why the notion of a potential ability is so attractive in modern capitalism and so disempowering to the mass of workers to whom it's applied. The word potential is a red flag for anyone cursed by coming into contact with the psychological clique that goes by the name the human potential movement. Though too often just a version of the self-help and self-improvement business, exhorting its followers to discover the real hidden inner you, the study of human potential began as something quite serious. In the writings of Abraham Maslow, for instance, human development was viewed as a lifelong negotiation between the genetic capacities of an individual and his or her experiences in society. In place of Freud's ideas about drives and instincts, Maslow sought a more plastic understanding of the self's formation in time. His conviction about continuous development appears today in the writings of Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum on what they call human capabilities. And again, like Maslow, the geneticist Richard Lewontin thinks of biology as furnishing a repertoire of human capacities used or not used variously over the course of a lifetime as circumstances demand. Now, this search for something potential, a capability that could be developed, that doesn't appear now, for which there is no craft maîtrise, no craft ownership, is a necessary project of the claim of meritocracy. That is because its claim would be that owing to prejudices of race, class, and gender, society may not tap into the talents of all of its members. This is a deeper claim than serving the needs of a particular kind of institution, like an advanced business. Rather, it equates the discovery of potential ability with justice tout court. That is what the social project, institutional project of talent would be about in this formulation, that the discovery of potential ability is equated with justice. And it's that claim that I want to dispute. In the United States, this meritocratic claim lay behind the erection of a certain kind of testing, a scholastic aptitude test, the SATs, familiar to any North American here. A cliche about American education says that the country's schools put little emphasis on knowing something, but a great deal of emphasis on knowing how to know. But the SAT set out at first not to eviscerate learning, but to complete the project of careers open to talent that began in those military academies 3 centuries before. In the years after the Second World War, the testers tried to figure out how to discover the potential to learn among young people from culturally deprived backgrounds. Now, you have to keep in mind that the testers' target was narrow: how to recruit a new elite of raw talent for universities like Harvard. The SAT drew on a very old American ideal, Thomas Jefferson's belief in a natural aristocracy, and it was small. So they aim only to get the top, at that time, 3% with these tests. The SAT tests themselves, however, began to transform this old ideal by framing ability in a new way. By comparing the SAT to the tests given in the military academy of Saint-Cyr in the mid-18th century, we understand what became new. Saint-Cyr asked the student, for instance, to perform a calculation using a quadratic equation, and then asked the student to explain in words what went into the process of calculation. In the section on patrie, which is country, Saint-Cyr asked for definitions of loyalty, courage, and sacrifice. The testers graded the response as to whether the pupil had given the graded the test as to whether the pupil had given the true response. In other words, these were tests of what we would call cultural achievement, or of achievement tout court, requiring for the quadratic equations a pre-existing mastery of how to translate numbers into words. I defy any of you to do this, by the way. Or for the entry on patrie, sufficient cultural impregnation to know just what would count in the examiner's minds as truly patriotic. There were few surprises in these tests, students being informed well in advance exactly what knowledge they would have to produce. The SAT assumed an innocent subject. Aptitude could be isolated from achievement by confronting the subject with a problem to be solved. The test tried to minimize pre-existent mathematical training. The process of mathematical reasoning was to be under the microscope. In the realm of words, the tests again probed the process of thinking in words rather than thinking correct thoughts. The mental world here is operational, process divorced from content, intelligence becoming process. Pure process. That is what intelligence appears in these tests. Here's how this works. In a prep book for the SAT addressing the seemingly most objective part of the test, the meaning of words. I'm sorry, this is to me almost pornographically interesting, maybe not to you. Here are two definitions offered for the word incisive. First, Following Huntley's incisive analysis, the bond traders were immediately galvanized into a frenzy of selling. Second, Cheryl's incisive coverage of City Hall affairs made her a formidable candidate for a Pulitzer Prize. Now, in principle, what a bond trader is, or what a Pulitzer Prize is treated as irrelevant cultural context to the process of reasoning. But when the definitions are paired together, they make for a puzzle. The first asks the teenager to assume that bond traders are people who act on incisive information. The second, that incisive information earns official rewards. Are bond traders, therefore, like literary prize judges? If not, is the point of incisive information that it was previously unknown? In that case, the synonym for incisive should be exposed, not, as the test coaches recommend, acute. Now, I bring this up to you because the only practical way to deal with the ambiguities of this process of association is not to dwell on them too much. The correct objective answer lies in the adolescent's mental service. By probing meaning, digging deep, one risks losing time and so doing a poor job on the exam. That's exactly what someone treating the tests in a craftsmanlike spirit would likely do. The exam is soft in the sense that at its very heart, this purely operational thinking requires mental superficiality. It requires it. Depth is fatal in these tests. And yet tests like this are meant to uncover innate ability. The brilliant young girl lost in the Chicago ghetto is taken to have a capacity fresh and ready to respond to the process of reasoning. In the testing room, her inner capacity is meant to step forward, casting off the chains of circumstance. The idea of potential ability as innocent of experience has to be a fiction. Psychologists like Howard Gardner have questioned why these two kinds of mental activities, mathematical and verbal, are treated as more innate, say, than visual or auditory understanding. Architects think in images, musicians in sounds. Even more elusive is emotional intelligence, hearing the intention behind another's words, tact, or empathy, capacity which profoundly affects performance in the world. The point of these objections is not to deny that ability exists, and that abilities are unequal. Rather, in the search to consummate the project of finding an elite, of constituting this Jeffersonian democracy, of finding people who can work in cutting-edge institutions which require process skills, the mental life of human beings has assumed a surface and narrow form. Social reference, sensate reasoning, and emotional understanding have been excluded from that search. Just have belief and truth. By a perverse irony, the more modern testers have sought to eliminate cultural bias from their work, the thinner has become the innate ability they test. Now, all of this would be depressing and perhaps interesting to us if it weren't that the claim about discovering potential ability is inflected with all of that historic baggage about merit and meritocracy. That is, that people who are the smartest are superior to those who aren't. And you can understand from what I've laid out here in this very cursory form, is that the irony that we face is that our definition for those who are superior are those who are best at thinking superficially. That meritocracy equates with a kind of slickness, a kind of processual slickness that earns people rewards in a rapidly shifting economy, particularly in kinds of business that are orientated to process rather than to digging deep into producing things. And it's for that reason that this is more than a depressing story about education itself. I'd like to conclude. If I would just add something to what I said before. This is when the philosopher Zygmunt Bauman used the phrase liquid modernity. It very well encapsulates exactly what this problem is. The liquidity means a lack of commitment. It's fluid, which is the way most of these organizations work. And it means something insubstantial. And that is, I believe, it's a very apt world for the relationship of the use of people's abilities in modern capitalism. I'd like to conclude this talk, somewhat disorganized talk, by going back to where I began, that is, to the issue of the fear of uselessness and what it has to this form of knowledge, this specter of uselessness. That specter looks different once we've described the kind of knowledge which is privileged at the cutting edge of the modern capitalist economy. The French philosopher Michel Foucault was the modern era's great analyst of the ways knowledge enables certain forms of power. He had in view the development of increasingly elaborated, dense knowledge, which would serve the purpose of ever more complete control over individuals and groups. For instance, the development of psychiatry was, in his view, intimately linked to the spread of institutions of incarceration. The Foucauldian scheme does not envisage superficial knowledge as a tool of power, and certainly not as a tool of inequality. And in this way, does not quite fit the framing of potential ability as it occurs in modern meritocracy. When Michael Young coined the term meritocracy, he meant to dramatize a society in which a small number of skilled people can control the entire society. Foucault made it a more detailed picture of this domination. The elite would get under the skin of the masses by making them feel that they really did not understand themselves, that they were inadequate interpreters of their own experience. And in that sense, he's relevant. His writing is relevant to our subject. Tests of potential ability show just how deeply under the skin a knowledge system can cut, even if what's being tested is the capacity to think superficially. Judgments about potential ability are much more personal in character than judgments of achievement. An achievement compounds social and economic circumstances, fortune and chance with self. Potential ability focuses only on the self. The statement, "you lack potential," is a much more devastating one than "you messed up." It makes a more fundamental claim about who you are. It conveys uselessness in a more profound sense. In institutions judging ability rather than achievement, they do try and avoid often making that devastating statement outright. You have no potential. Still, what the untalented feel is that they become invisible. And this is the last thing I'd really like to stress with you. They drop from view in this system. That is the way in which failure works both in schools and in workplaces. By focusing on who has ability, the system makes those who don't have ability feel that they simply don't count, that they're not recognized. And here we owe the insight to what this is what this feels like, again, to Michael Young in his marvelous, and I think unfortunately now out of print book, Meritocracy. His notion was that the punishment for not being agile was not blame or even overt expressions of contempt, but an indifference. And that, I would say, is what, in the interviews that I've been doing with workers who have, middle-aged workers who have lost their jobs, has fused that cultural formation, has fused with the facts about who, how much workers are paid in China, or how ageist are the institutions that have let them go. What lies in the background is the development of this cultural form in which once you seem to no longer have ability, you simply become invisible. Indifference is your punishment. And it's for that reason that I think the whole way, to sum up, in which we've thought about the question of ability has to be rethought. The sociological penalties for privileging meritocracy and meritocratic forms of talent, which are potential ability, over those of craftsmanship are enormous. The more, in my view, that the sheer scarcity of jobs becomes an issue in the West, the more that material scarcity is going to intersect with the kind of cultural dynamic that I've tried to lay out to you tonight, where people think that they have nothing in themselves which is of real value. In my view, what we should be thinking about in educational and particularly in work policy is therefore how to make craftsmanship meritorious. That is, how to give craftsmanship a kind of moral standing. And that's not just a matter of good feeling. It means changing the ways in which, I can't speak about schools, but our work institutions operate, that people are rewarded for having what is sometimes called domain knowledge, for accumulating experience, for digging deep into problems, for becoming ingrown. That's a very different proposition about ability than the one that now dominates our thinking in talking about what talent means. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard, for a wonderful, elegant, obviously well-crafted talk. And I think at least three key issues come to mind. One is the distinction between meritocracy and craftsmanship, which clearly pervades the argument. Secondly, the claim about the functionality of meritocracy for advanced capitalism. And the third is about the policy implications. These are, at least to me, three key issues that we might now invite discussion of. If it's not quite a standard LSE audience, I would just say we usually take questions in clusters of four or five to give you a chance to raise a diversity of issues, and then Richard will have a few moments to respond, and then we'll take another cluster. We've got half an hour, so we have some time to explore some of these questions.
Do I have half an hour in me?
We have as long as you wish to go. It can be 20 minutes. So can I see hands for questions on some of the issues raised?
Yes.
A mic's coming. Perhaps you introduce yourself and then ask.
My name is Gavin. I'm just a visitor. Discovered your lectures the other day. Going back to the start of your talk about the threat of...
Can you speak up a bit?
Sorry. Going back to the start of your talk about the threat of skilled workers overseas and automation. If that's the case, why do we have record levels of employment at the moment in the UK? If there are these threats, why isn't there large-scale unemployment?
Uh-huh.
Can you just take some more?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Anyone else? Yes, please, gentlemen up there.
Hello? Hi. My name's Nick. I'm a third-year student here. Since inequality is a key issue in this talk, I wondered what your view would be on how you would prevent, if you end up with a situation that you suggest that's better, i.e. people are craftsmen rather than thinking superficially or whatever. I mean, I would say that one benefit of this testing people is that you reduce inequality resulting from people's backgrounds because they've been cultured in the way they were brought up or something like that. And I wonder what you would propose replacing this kind of system with, because you run into danger of taking us back to a situation where people born into very wealthy families just sell through the system because they're, you know, they're automatically immersed in culture.
Good question.
Great. I'm looking around. Yes, please.
Isn't culture really all about inequality? In other words, can you have a culture which is absolutely equal? That seemed to me a contradiction.
I know we're at the LSC now. Small question.
And, you know, I think talent also, by its very nature, is a very rare phenomenon. And its rarity leads some people to think that this is all about elitism, which you haven't really mentioned at all in your talk, the basic phenomenon of elitism in culture.
I wonder what the connection in your talk between craft and the age argument is. I mean, it seems that there's a privileging of experience that favors people who have more experience and are older, therefore. And what does that do for young people in terms of how they're supposed to conceive of their future and of their career as they go into it, rather than being, you know, young sort of firecrackers that can go out there and do something brilliant, as having to sort of start this long, heavy road.
And just one more in the cluster of five. Yeah, please.
Hello, Richard. Actually, I've got a general question. I read an article in Le Monde which referred to your work. And the title of the article was, "Is Capitalism Dying?" And my question is, having talked about that, what do you think, what is going to happen to capitalism? Is it going to survive? Or because it was the content of the article, so I want to know what do you think about it? Thanks.
Well, that's a small one. Richard, the floor is yours.
Fine, you'll bring in a bed and people will well, these are all good questions. I take the last one most seriously. Let me say to the issue, the very important issue you raise about unemployment as a measure, unemployment numbers as a measure of job dispossession. And I'm going to talk to you a little technically about this. What we are very bad at doing in the UK, and so are the Americans, is trying to understand. We take raw numbers of getting a paycheck each week. We're very bad at understanding flows upward and downward in terms of the quality of work that people are doing, or even in the UK, which is sinful, changes in people's pay as they move from job to job. That is, when we reckon unemployment, what we're not accounting is a phenomenon that's becoming increasingly marked, which is that people are moving out of certain kinds of jobs where they've been able to employ skills
to jobs where they are less able to put in. I'm going to use this thing. Can you hear me with this? Yeah. Skills. The data is bad on that, and there's a political reason why the data is bad on that. In the United States, in the Reagan, we had very good ways of measuring de-skilling up until the Reagan era. Then we stopped measuring it. We had excellent measures, technical measures for doing it. So what I would say to you about this is that the sheer numbers of people unemployed is a very bad way to get into the issue of job loss. If we could get governments to make the measures, a much better way would be a very simple one, which is when you lose a job, is the next job you get consonant with what you were doing before? And it's very hard to get that data. The issue, I want to just say one other thing about this in terms of automation. When the post-industrial thesis came in, this is an idea we owe to Alain Touraine and to Daniel Bell. The notion was that what automation would do is basically take away the simplest manual jobs, and that what would replace them would be middle-class human services jobs. That was their, I can't say hope, but that was their belief was that the working classes would basically become small and this service middle class would become large. That hasn't happened in part because a lot of service jobs are also automated. There was a study that's just been completed of the back offices of accounting firms, for instance, which are wastelands of unemployed accountants for the obvious reason that we've now got the technology to do reckoning of a much higher caliber than used to be done by human hands. Some analysts of labor today, like Michael Piori, argue that in fact what's happening is we're having a re-inflating of the lowest levels of the working class. That it still remains cheaper to hire a pair of hands to sweep the streets than to buy a good machine. To sweep, you know, a man with a broom is cheaper than one of those Camden Council machines. So the other side of this issue is in the view, and Piori has some very compelling data about this, that what we're going to see is the swelling at the real bottom ranks of the social order of lots of work of manual labor as a result of automation. Now, the second question that I was asked is, well, what kind of tests would be better than the kinds of tests we have now? And I guess I can give you an answer about that that's based on the workplace, but not about the educational system, which I try and know as little as I can about. Sorry, Tony, this is not... In a workplace, testing often replaces employee file records in which somebody is actually describing how well somebody has done a job, mastered a skill, how they behave with other people, and so on. It does that partially because the record is much simpler to provide in the workplace, to retest people's abilities every 2 years rather than provide what used to be called work narratives. There is a structural reason for that as well, that in the kinds of firms that I study at this cutting edge, there's much more mobility among higher level managers than there is among people at the bottom. So the witnesses for how well you've performed a job are leaving more often than the employees who they could evaluate. It's particular in, well, I won't mention the firm, but in a well-known financial services firm that we studied, the turnover among people on the in one sector of their bond trading department, when you got below a certain level, the turnover was about once every 23 months. As you moved up the scale in this bond trading department, each step up the bureaucratic ladder meant that people were leaving quicker. So that the witnesses to actually test you are disappearing. British Publishing, another notorious instance of this, the kind of revolving door of editors. I don't say anything about the BBC, but the publishing world, very well known for this. The structural problem here is that the kind of evaluation on the job that would actually delve in to what somebody has done is losing the institutions themselves are losing the structures where there are the people who can do that. And so the reversion is constantly to, is this employee capable of being moved, which is the point of all these jobs, not how well did they do it. So that's the problem in the work world. That's the issue we face there. What would replace the SATs in schools that would be culture neutral? I don't know. My own belief about this, as somebody who grew up in the working class, is that working class people are not deprived of cultural capital, and that therefore achievement tests are not something that are necessarily going to work at the to the disadvantage of working class kids. But as I say, this is a mere guess. It is, if I just flesh this out though for a second, I mean, part, there is a kind of condescension built into the notion that that poor kids or working class kids have no cultural capital, that they don't know how things work. You know, that they're stuck in this places where people are dealing drugs and drinking and having sex all the time. They've never had the discipline to learn about the outside world. And it's a very condescending attitude. But it produces this notion that we mustn't do anything that might possibly ask them to think like middle class people. You know, it's quite worrying to me.
That's only number one.
That's number two, thank God. Should I be briefer?
Briefer.
I've never been brief in my life, and you've known me for years.
Briefer, because we have one or two more questions.
Okay. About the question, does culture equal inequality? Let's pass, okay, for the moment, because there are arguments to be made about it. I remind you that R.H. Tony, the great writer on equality, never argued that what he wanted was, he accepted the notion that human variation meant differences in ability. The notion for Tony was, how much unnecessary inequality can we get rid of? And Tony's answer to that was, we can get rid of quite a great deal if we change the way the capitalist system works. Let's leave it at that. That's an answer Ralph Miliband would have liked to. The question about craft and age is a really interesting one. The old guild notion was that you really couldn't do something well until you were about 45 or 50. And at least in, and that's wrong. I mean, children, you don't need to be a musical prodigy to learn how to play an instrument well by the time you're 12. Kids learn how to play sports very early on. There are lots of what are called domain knowledges that young people can pick up in a 2 or 3 year period. The problem is whether they're rewarded for picking up that, making the effort to pick up that kind of domain knowledge. You know? And the notion that you would if you were choosing two university students and you'd taken the one who was sort of less agile but had probed deeper in a particular subject over the one who was more agile but knew less, would be a great shift in the way we thought about the relative worth of skill. That's the problem. I'm going really fast here. About the question whether capitalism is dying, I need a drink for that, and we'll deal with this. Can we take one or two more? I have to apologize for being so long-winded.
We'll just take two more.
Two more, and then we'll have drinks.
And then one for me.
Oh, God. All right.
Hi. I'm wondering in this duality that you brought about in the age of craftsmanship as against meritocracy, and looking at the way things are happening today, would people understand what to respect at all? And what would respect mean today?
Okay.
This talk made me reflect about my recent research about NHS Direct. And basically, this is a new service. And nurses from different backgrounds, they became like call center operators.
Yeah.
And what I did some ethnographic research in call center and many interviews. And what I found out, some issue of resistance of these nurses, because initially there was a deep enthusiasm of, you know, starting this new job. Then they realized that, you know, it's a routinized job. They're basically losing their, you know, their skills. They missed the interaction with the patients. And what is happening, particularly in the London call center, in the London hospital, is that many nurses, they're starting as a full-time, and they drop from full-time and part-time. So reflecting on this, I thought that this was a kind of resistance of the workers. And basically, many nurses, they are doing part-time in the call center and part-time in hospital setting.
Okay.
I just want to know, what do you think about the issue of resistance, worker resistance regarding these issues?
Okay.
Me? Huh?
You.
I found it very compelling what you said, and the craft of the way you said it, but I'm having a little difficulty with the distinction between meritocracy and craftsmanship, and merit as measured in the way you'd set it out, and craftsmanship, and how to apply this distinction, and maybe that's the wrong question. But if you take some examples, surgeons versus carpenters, directors of the LSE, the current director is sitting up there, versus silversmiths, generals versus, say, corgi plumbers, you could say the former are in positions because they've achieved tests through merit, so on, through a meritocratic system. And the latter are there through the craftsmanships and the skills they've developed and the work they have done and what they have to display by virtue of those skills. But that doesn't easily do it, that doesn't quite work, nor does it really specify what constitutes the capabilities in both cases. Because the director of the LSE needs, you know, merit, certification, on-the-job success, experience, as it were, to constitute the range of skills and capacities needed for that job. And the plumber needs a similar range of knowledge-based cognitive skills and experience on the job in order to be a crafted plumber. So I'm wondering whether it's even the right question to think about how you make these distinctions work with respect to a range of occupations which actually show overlapping both merit and skill, craftsmanship, and
good question.
Basis. And in thinking about it, I just need a little more illumination as to see.
Okay.
But maybe that's the wrong level of the question.
Okay. I'm glad you asked a long question.
5 minutes.
Actually, the answers I give to all, or responses I give to all three of you, I perhaps can illuminate by talking about something I cut out in the talk, which is in my book. It's a very interesting set of studies originated by an American sociologist named Otis Dudley Duncan, who asked people, what job, what work do you admire? and a list of hundreds of jobs. It's done in the U.S., then it was replicated in Britain, then it was replicated in Europe, and now it's just been replicated in India. The results are quite striking in their similarity. You find, for instance, that doctors, as you expect, would be highly admired jobs. Close to doctors are cabinet makers. Executives are far down the ladder. Politicians almost at the bottom, yes, thank God. But over the course, since this is a set of studies that have been done, this Duncan Prestige Scale, it's been done over a long period of time, people have asked, well, why are we getting, how do we get this jumble of work that people respect that seems not to obey any of the normal things we think about as in terms of cash, manual versus mental, and so on. And the best answer that's been found to this is that what people respect in work is a capacity for autonomy. And that a doctor, cabinet maker, are basically in control of their own work. And as that explanation has been probed, what people mean by autonomy is the something quite specific, the chance to develop your understanding of what you do. So that quick-term jobs, you know, where you immediately get it, where there's no depth in it, no hinterland in it, or transactional work like that of the politician, which is a one-off, vote for me, don't vote for me, don't elicit much respect because there seems to be no narrative of development in it. And that's what constitutes the autonomy. So it's interesting to me because it's another way, to come back to your question, to get to the issue, what would you mean by craftsmanship? Well, we mean something that we can gradually deepen, where there's an experience to be had doing that kind of work. And the data is remarkably similar across all these cultural divides, is what the kind of work that people respect. Thank you for your information about NHS Direct. It's quite interesting. And particularly, your notion that going to work part-time is a way of resisting the conditions of that kind of labor. That it's an arresting idea, and I hadn't thought of it. There is a good study to be done, and eventually I'm going to have some people do it here, about all aspects of medical workers in terms of craftsmanship, issues of craftsmanship. I've talked quite frequently to groups of doctors about this subject who believe that the current arrangements, both in Britain and the United States, for HMOs in the United States, their variants here in Britain, are depriving them of self-respect and knowledge that only a more craftsmanlike dedication to the work would entail. That is, getting it right for its own sake. I spoke to a group of surgeons recently who said, you know, people always complain to us that surgeons look at you and they say a liver or a pancreas. And now we're forced to behave like the stereotype because of the way in which the health service is organized. So that the notion of actually understanding they perform operations without having any chance to follow on through with the patient, to know the patient's history and the like. Those are erosions of a kind of commitment to doing something well for its own sake in a very well-paid sphere of work with lots and lots of unhappy people. When I've talked about this issue of craftsmanship with him, it turns on a light bulb about what it is that is being eroded in the sense of their work. To your question, whether everything isn't a mixture of meritocratic recognition and craftsman-like experience. I think in principle that's probably right. The issue gets to be what are the economic and political circumstances under which there's a balance between those two. My argument in this book is that what we're moving away from is putting much value on depth knowledge, and therefore on good work. And that the economy privileges superficial work and superficiality. So ideally, there should be some way of testing, being impersonal about it, looking towards the future, thinking about what people might do, just as well as there is an emphasis on achievement. But the reason I gave you this talk in this form is to try and bring home, and maybe this is a good way to end this, that achievement is counting for less and less in the skills society. That's a sociological problem. And when achievement counts for less and less sociologically, human beings count for less and less to themselves. That's the argument I want to make to you. Well, thank you for being such an attentive audience, and it's time for drink.
Okay, many thanks.
Very good question. You should tell me.